that made it hard to get into without a stepladder. He climbed inside the cab amid the clutter of cassettes and paper cups. He found what he was looking for and did the same thing he did every Friday afternoon in those lousy waning hours before game time. The pounding of the drums came on first, then the scream of, "Hey!" Then the sound of a guitar like that of 10-inch fingernails sliding up and down a blackboard, that explosive sounds moving back and forth between the speakers. There were more guttural yells, more screeching snippets of guitar, then the sudden ominous wail of an organ that kept building and building and made his heart beat a little faster. The guitars dug into his ears, and the lyrics poured into his veins like liquid fire. The louder the better, the angrier the better. Every sound aimed to strike right at the top of the skull and just rattle up there for a little while, get trapped in there, like a ball bouncing repeatedly off a wall. Lay your hands on me, 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 lay your hands on me. Thank God for Bon Jovi. McDougal closed the tiny eyes of his face and leaned his head against the back of the seat. He waited to see if the feeling would be there, as it had been a couple of weeks ago when Permian had beaten the hell out of the Bulldogs and taught them a thing or two about having the fucking nerve to step on the same field with the Panthers, the boys in black. And it was, yes, it was, a series of chills shooting down his back straight to his spine like lightning splitting a tree, a tingling feeling that both reassured and excited him. And at that moment, at that very moment, he knew there was no way that Permian could lose to Midland Lee tonight. No fucking way. Not as long as he was alive. It was all that mattered to him. Not because it was a ticket to anything or a way out of this town that held as many secrets as the back of his hand. Long before, when he had stopped growing at 5'9", he had put away all lofty dreams of playing for the University of Texas, or anywhere else for that matter. He knew that all he was, when you got to the core of it, was an offensive tackle with a lot of heart, but little natural ability. After the season, there would be plenty of time to think about college and careers and all that other stuff that a high school senior might want to start thinking about. But not now. Not when the most important moment of his life was about to take place. Friday night is what he lived for, bled for, worked so hard for. It sure as hell wasn't school, where he shuffled from one cream puff course to another. It wasn't the prospect of going into the oil business either, where he had watched his father's company, built with sweat and tears, slide through the continued depression in oil prices. I'm a fighter, I'm a poet, I'm a preacher. I've been to school, and baby, I've been the teacher. If you show me how to get up off the ground, I can show you how to fly and never, ever come back down. Thank God for Bon Jovi. The tingling sensation stayed with him, and he knew that when he stepped on that field tonight, he wouldn't feel like a football player at all, but like someone much more powerful entering a glittering, barbaric arena. It's like the gladiators, was the way he once described it. It's like the Christians and the lions, like Caesar standing up there and saying yay or nay. There's 19,000 fans in the stands, and they can't do what you're doing, and they're all cheering for one thing. They're cheering for you. Man, that's a high no drug or booze or a woman can give you. He pulled back into the school parking lot. He left his pickup and entered the locker room of the field house where everything had been laid out the night before with the meticulousness of a Christmas display window. The shoes and the shoulder pads and the socks and the pants all in their proper places. The helmets fresh and gleaming from the weekly hand cleaning by one of the student trainers. Mike Winchell hated these moments in the field house. wandering around in his uniform as the minutes dripped away with excruciating slowness. Secretly, he wished that he could be knocked out and not wake up until 5 minutes before game time, when there was no longer any time to dwell on it. He was the quarterback, and that gave him a certain status, because just about everybody in town knew who the quarterback was, and the novelty of having his picture in the local paper had worn off long ago. But with all the responsibilities, learning the audible calls and the three-play packages, not getting fooled by that overshifted defense the Rebels like to run, it was hard not to feel overwhelmed. He awoke early that day in the darkness of the shabby house on Texas Avenue that shamed him so much he wouldn't even let his girlfriend enter it. In silence, he had carefully wrapped up some toast and bacon in paper towels so that he would have something to eat when he got to school. Then he got his mother up so she could drive him there, since, unlike most kids at Permian High School, he didn't have his own car. They barely said anything to each other because he hated questions about the game. When she dropped him off, she whispered, "Good luck," and then left. Once he got to school, he had to go to the pep rally, where his long, angular face, framed by balloons, had a look of delicate sadness, as haunting as a Diane Arbus photograph. It was a fascinating face, Huck Finnish, high cheekboned, yet somehow devoid of expression, the eyes flat and deadened against the roar and tumult that surrounded him, impervious to it, unable to react. He welcomed going to class afterward, finding relief in the equations spread across the blackboard in Algebra 2, glad to have something else filling his head besides the thousand and one things that were expected of him. But outside class, the pressure intensified again. The league game hovering over him like a thundercloud, the incessant questions of the students as he walked through the halls driving him crazy and offering him no escape. Everyone seemed uptight to him, even the teachers who always dressed up in black on game day. When he walked through the halls of school during the season, it wasn't as a proud gladiator, but instead he seemed enveloped in an almost painful shyness, his head ducked to the side and his eyes shifting furtively, fending off questions with one-word answers, especially hating it when people came up to him and asked, "Do y'all think you're going to win?" He had first started as a junior, and back then he had been so nervous that the butterflies started on Tuesdays. In the huddle, his hands shook. Teammates looked at him and wondered if he was going to make it. But this season, he was leading the district in passing and had cut his interceptions down to almost none. A big game against the Rebels would be further vindication, further proof that he had what it took to be a college quarterback in the Southwest Conference. There could have been other options for him. During the season, he had gotten a letter from Brown expressing interest in him because he was not only a decent quarterback, but a good student. But for Winchell, who had never been east of the Texas-Louisiana border, the mere idea scared him to death. Rhode Island? Where in God's name was Rhode Island? He looked on a map, and there it was, halfway across the earth. So tiny, it could move into West Texas overnight and no one would ever know it, taking its anonymous place beside Wink and Kermit and No Trees and Mentone. Hell, Brown. That might as well have been in India, was the way he put it. He had read about the Ivy League in the sports pages and seen a few of those games on ESPN where the caliber of play wasn't too bad, but it sure as heck wasn't football the way he had grown up to understand football. He also got a nibble of interest from Yale, but when he tried to imagine what these schools were like, all he could think of was people standing around in goofy sweaters with little Ys on the fronts yelling, "Go Yale, beat Brown!" A series of meetings was held in the field house, the five Permian coaches trying to pound in the game plan against Lee one more time. Afterward, as part of a long-standing tradition, all the lights were turned off. Some of the players lay on the floor or slumped against concrete posts. Some listened to music, the tinny sound from their headphones like violent whispering in a serious domestic spat. Winchell, who had gone over the audible calls in his mind yet again, agonized over the wait. It was the worst part of all, the very worst. After several minutes, the lights came back on and he and his teammates boarded the yellow school buses waiting outside. With the flashers of a police escort leading the way so there wouldn't be any wait at the traffic lights, the caravan made its way to Ratliff Stadium like a presidential motorcade. The sound of vomiting echoed through the dressing room of the stadium. The retching, the physical embodiment of the ambivalence Ivory Christian felt about what he was doing and why he was there. Droplets of sweat trickled down his face as he lay in front of the porcelain. None of the other players paid much notice. They had heard it before and gave little half smiles. It was just Ivory. There was so much about football he hated. The practices, the conditioning, the expectations that because he was a captain, he had to be Joe Rah-Rah. He wasn't sure if he cared about beating Midland Lee. He wasn't sure if he cared about winning the district championship and getting into the playoffs. Let other players dream their foolish dreams about getting recruited by a big-time school. It wasn't going to happen to him. And he figured that after the year was over, he would enlist in the Marines or something. Maybe buy a Winnebago so he could get out of this place and drive around the country without a care in the world where no one could get to him. But the game had a funny hold on him. The elemental savagery of it appealed to him, and he was good at it. Damn good. Strong, fast, quick. A gifted middle linebacker with a future potential he didn't begin to fathom. Severing from it, letting go, was not going to be as easy as he thought it would be, particularly in Odessa, where if you were big and strong and fast and black, it was difficult not to feel as if the whole world expected you to do one thing and one thing only, and that was play football. And despite the grim detachment with which he seemed to approach almost everything, he seemed scared to death at the thought of failing at it. He loved it, and he hated it, and he hated it, and he loved it. After he had finished vomiting, he reappeared in the dressing room with a relieved smile on his face. He had gone through the catharsis. He had gotten it out of his system, the ambivalence, the fear. Now, he was ready to play. Every sound in the dressing room in the final minutes seemed amplified 1,000 times. The jagged, repeated rips of athletic tape, the clip of cleats on the concrete floor like that of tap shoes, the tumble of aspirin and Tylenol spilling from plastic bottles like the shaking of bones to ward off evil spirits. The faces of the players were young, but the perfection of their equipment, the gleaming shoes and helmets and the immaculate pants and jerseys, the solemn ritual that was attached to almost everything, made them seem like boys going off to fight a war for the benefit of someone else, unwitting sacrifices to a strange and powerful god. In the far corner of the dressing room, Booby Miles sat on a bench with his eyes closed, his face a mixture of seriousness and sadness, showing no trace of what this pivotal night would hold for him. Jared McDougal, pacing back and forth, went to the bathroom to wipe his face with paper towels. Staring into the mirror, he checked to make sure his shirt was tucked in and the sleeves were taped. He straightened his neck roll and then put on his gloves to protect his hands, the last touches of gladiatorial splendor. It looked good. It looked damn good. In the distance, he could hear the Midland Lee band playing Dixie, and it enraged him. He hated that song and the way those cocky bastards from Lee swaggered to it. His face became like that of an impulse killer, slitty-eyed, filled with anger. Mike Winchell lay on the floor, seduced by its coldness and how good it felt. His eyes closed, but the eyelids still fluttered, and you could feel the nervousness churning inside him. In the silence of that locker room, it was hard not to admire these boys as well as fear for them. Hard not to get caught up in the intoxicating craziness of it. Hard not to whisper, "My God," at how important the game had become, not only to them, but to a town whose spirits crested and fell with each win and each loss. You wished for something to break that tension, a joke, a sigh, a burst of laughter, a simple phrase to convince them that if they lost to the Rebels tonight, it wasn't the end of the world, that life would go on as it always had. Gary Gaines, the coach of Permian, called the team to gather around him. He was a strikingly handsome man, with a soft smile and rows of pearly white teeth somehow unstained, as if by divine intervention, from the toxic-looking thumbnails of tobacco snuff that he snuck between front lip and gum when his wife wasn't around to catch him. He had beautiful eyes, not quite gray, not quite blue, filled with softness and reassurance. His message was short and sincere. "Nobody rest a play, men. Don't coast on any play. You're on that field, you give it everything you got." Across the field in the visitors' dressing room, Earl Miller, the coach of the Rebels, gave similar advice in his thick Texas twang that made every syllable seem as long as a sentence. "First time you step out on that field, you go down there as hard as you can and bust somebody." Brian Chavez's eyes bulged as he made his way to the coin toss with the other captains. On one side was Ivory Christian, belching and hiccuping and trying to stop himself from retching again. On the other was Mike Winchell, lost in a trance of intensity. The three of them held hands as they walked down a ramp and then turned a corner to catch the first glimpse of a sheet of fans dressed in black that seemed to stretch forever into the desert night. The farther they moved into the stadium field, the more it felt as if they were entering a fantastic world, a world unlike any other. The metamorphosis began to take hold of Chavez when the game began and he took the field. His body would be vibrating, and his heart would be beating fast, and every muscle in his body would become taut. He knew he would try to hit his opponent as hard as he possibly could from his tight end position, to hurt him, to scare him with his 215-pound frame that was the strongest on the team, to make him think twice about getting back up again. It was the whole reason he played football, for those hits, for those acts of physical violence that made him tingle and feel wonderful, for those quintessential shots that made him smile from ear to ear and earned him claps on the back from his teammates when he drove some defensive lineman to the sidelines and pinned him right on his butt. He knew he was an asshole when he played, but he figured it was better to be, as he saw it, an asshole playing football rather than in real life. He had no other expectations beyond the physical thrill of it. He didn't have to rely on it or draw all his identity from it. "I played because I like it," he once said. "Others played because it was Permian football. It was their ticket to popularity. It was just a game to me, a high school game." As the number one student in his class, his aspirations extended far beyond the glimmer of expectation that a Texas school, any Texas school, might be willing to give him a football scholarship. He had set his sights differently, zeroing in on a target that seemed incomprehensible to his family, his friends, just about everyone. He wanted to go to Harvard. When he tried to imagine it, he thought it would be like stepping into a different world, a world that was steeped in history and breathtaking and so utterly different from the finite world of Odessa, which spread over the endless horizon like the unshaven stubble of a beard. When he visited it his senior year, He sat by the window of his hotel and watched the rowers along the Charles with their seemingly effortless grace, the strokes of their oars so delicate and perfectly timed as they skipped.